Good morning on Tuesday, June 23rd, 2015. This is Brian Madden, and you're listening to a BrianMadden.com live podcast. I'm sitting in my living room in San Francisco. I'm also joined via Skype by Jack, whom I assume is in the studio.
That is correct.
And our guest today is Dane Young, who is joining us from Sacramento.
Hello, everyone.
Before the show started, we were chatting about domain names and various domain names that we have. You know, I've got BrianMadden.com. I also have BMAD.com, B-M-A-D. And I have FUIT.com, F-U-I-T.com. Jack, I know you do not have JackMadden.com.
Right. I have JackMadden.net, but there is currently nothing there.
I think you know, .net was always for years like the kind of loser. Like, the only reason you were at .net is if you didn't get the .com.
But now that we have... Did you just call your brother a loser?
I said for years it was. But now we have, like, .us and .wuss and ., you know, software and .arrow and ., you know, drugs or whatever those other... There's a billion other ones. So I feel like .net has, you know, certain understated charm to it now.
Maybe like, it's like the hipster domain name.
yeah, like a
I
AOL.
Dot me. I thought dot me was the hipster one.
Oh, or me.com. So, no, but Dane, you're young. I mean, you blog on what ITVCE, I think, right?
Yeah, exactly.
But your Twitter handle is Young Tech. Like, your name's Dane Young, obviously. So, but do you have a like Young Tech domain, or where'd that come from?
I tried to grab Young Tech domain, but it's already taken by some company in New Jersey somewhere. But
lame.
I might buy them out at some point. I really like Young Tech. For a long time, people didn't put the connection together that it was my last name. They just figured, oh, he's young and he's in technology, so it's Young Tech. But no, it's really just because of my last name. I jumped on the Gmail bandwagon very early on, so I was able to snag youngtech@gmail.com. So I'm pretty happy about that.
And you've been, I mean, you're not so young anymore.
Yeah, I don't know. It's all relative, I guess. Everything is in certain perspective. I think, there's certain areas where I'm not young anymore, where there's people coming right out of college that are doing tech and IT and consumerization and all that. But I think, for where I'm at in the industry, I think I'm still on the younger side.
So I don't want to talk about that because, you know, we've been having just different guests on the show each week and just kind of talking about what's going on in the industry and that sort of stuff. And I want to, you know, there's some Windows 10 stuff I want to talk about, some Citrix stuff. But also, Dane, I want to talk about your Briforum sessions because you gave a session at Briforum London about Citrix, the web. What am I forgetting the names?
I'm going to see if he can botch it. I'm not going to bail you out.
Web Workspace Cloud. Thank you. Citrix Workspace
there
Cloud.
There you go.
I want to
there
say Web CWC meant Citrix Web Console, like back in the day, you know, and I almost said Citrix Web Console. But Citrix Workspace Cloud. And you talked about GPUs also. I want to talk about that. Do you have an upcoming session on Moonshot at the next Brian Forum?
I do.
Is that your last one?
Yeah.
I want to talk about Moonshot, too, because I don't get Moonshot, so I want to talk about that. But first, though, you know, you've spoken at a bunch of Briforums before. Is that right? Or am I making
that
up?
I think last year was the first Briforum that I spoke at, and then I attended a couple before that.
Okay,
but I think last year in Boston was the first one that I spoke at.
And then so how did you get? Because I don't remember meeting you ever. Maybe. Like, you feel like to me someone I've known for a long time. Do we meet at CTPs eventually, originally years ago? I don't recall, but.
Yeah, it's just because I'm so memorable, you know. It's hard to say. No, I think we met at the first Briforum. You were in the process of exiting the CTP program, and I was in the process of entering the CTP program. And that was the first Briforum that I went to. So we met there. And I was like, hey, you know, how's it going, Brian? So great to meet you. You know, I'm just in the process of entering the CTP program. And you're like, oh, okay, cool. Like, who are you?
all right, I'll see you again never.
Yeah, exactly. You're like, he's a nobody. I'm never going to see him again. And as it turns out, yeah, we've just gotten to know each other over the years. But I'm glad to hear that it seems like we've known each other forever. That's great.
Yeah. But so how did you how did you end up? You know, one of the questions I'm always curious about with when we have guests is how you got into technology in the first place and how you got into IT. And then how'd you get into this sort of like, you know, Citrix niche? IT.
Yeah. And I do get, you know, stonecast or typecast as the Citrix niche, but I do like to consider myself a generalist still around all things end user computing. But, you know, end user computing has been characterized as Citrix for so many years. I think, you know, from a young age and Jack, Brian, you guys can probably relate, just always hands-on technology, trying to break things and fix them and all of that kind of stuff. I was very early in the PC building type of days. Anytime I could get a couple grand scrapped together, I was building something. And sometimes I would sell them and sometimes I would keep them and all of that. And knew that I wanted to go to school for something related to technology. Wasn't really sure what that was, and found myself in kind of the mix between business and technology at a local university, CSU Sacramento up here, and was working my way through, you know, a college program, got connected just through course of random events, got connected with a guy who was in the consulting business, but not for virtualization or end user computing, but more for networks, doing diagnostics and throughput analysis and understanding where customers' choke points were. And just, it was totally fortuitous that I got connected with him. And he needed a sysadmin to take care of his marketing and sales and those types of staff. He was scaled down at that point. At the height, he had probably 20 people that were working for him. But when I started with him, he had about a dozen. And, you know, his big hallmark was apparently when 9/11 happened, which, you know, those of us that are in the States remember that very well, apparently the aircraft went through the Pentagon and took out the IT director, the CIO, all the network senior architects on the networking side, and left their IT infrastructure in shambles. Well, he was one of the guys that when the Pentagon was trying to figure out, like, how do we put all the pieces back together, they called around to a number of different places, and eventually everybody kept pointing them back to him. So he assembled a team, and they went in and took care of the Pentagon after that horrific event. So he, you know, made me his protege, learned a lot about consulting, and, you know, got to travel around with him pretty much as, you know, no experience junior, still working through college. Decided that it was important for me to finish my degree at that point, so I did that. And then, you know, I got that early taste in my mouth about consulting and knew from that point, like, I need to get enough chops and enough experience to be able to go back out and do consulting. I don't know what field that's going to be in, but I really, really enjoyed the fast-paced, dynamic nature of what I saw him doing.
Does this make you like one of the first guests that we had that actually like successfully completed a degree?
It might be. And if not, I'm probably the only guest you've had that successfully completed two degrees.
or an IT degree also. That's the thing. There's a lot of like Jack has a music degree.
Two of them.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah, and like Rick Mack is a zoologist, and you know, like things like that.
Yeah. So I did finish my degree. Yay, congratulations on that. Got a bachelor's in what's called management information systems, which is like the intersection between business and IT. And that's helped me a lot over the years, actually. Then I took some internal IT positions as desktop support, call desk, support desk, network support, servers, you name it, just things that I could get that, you know, years of experience as it was, you know, pretty important starting out to be able to cut my chops. And then I went over to a company that focused in the managed services space, and that was quite an experience. Managed service is basically like outsourced IT, more or less. And they were doing consulting, they were doing projects you know, in the early days of VMware, they were doing vSphere GSX and ESX implementations. So I got a lot of experience there doing some early days Citrix presentation server 4.0 is as far back as I go. There's a lot of people in this space that go much further back than that. But, you know, 4.0 on 2000 and 2003, that's kind of where I got my first exposure to terminal services and Citrix. And did a lot of projects, a lot of implementations for, well, as managed services, you kind of have to be a jack of all trades and attack a lot of different things. So we would do Exchange right beside Active Directory and VMware and Citrix and firewalls and network switches and routers and things like that, basically everything that IT shops would need. And because it was managed...
Oh, sorry. Yeah, I was going to say, and then kind of fast forwarding to now, you're doing, you're on the consulting sort of reseller side of business, and you're, you know, seeing Citrix in like a lot of different customers.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So just kind of up-leveled it, went to a larger company that dealt in more of the mid-market and enterprise space, and now I get to touch, you know, all kinds of virtualization, Citrix, end-user computing for, you know, mid-market and enterprise space.
Without naming names, are you able to like broadly say like ZenApp today? Like, you know, do you see more ZenApp, you know, 6.5 versus ZenApp 7?
Yeah, I think the large majority of it at this point is 6.5. Most customers that wanted to get off of 2003, 6.5 was their logical landing place. But any implementations that we're doing these days in 2015 and even 2014 to a degree, new environments are the large majority are 7.x.
Did the 6.5 extension, like, was that news? Like, was that well received by customers who you know, or did they already have plans to get off of 6.5?
There's a lot of large customers that are still on 6.5, so I think, you know, that ultimately helps. I think extended support, you know, from a Citrix perspective is it's a bit of a ticking time bomb because nobody wants to pay the exorbitant fees that extended support goes along with. So most everybody's working under standard support. Even though the operating system is supported well after that, most customers have to stay on a more rapid upgrade timeline. So,
and then what about Hyper-V versus Zen Server versus vSphere?
Oh, man, you're just busting out all of the tough questions.
I'm just curious on, like, what people are using out there, you know?
Yeah, I'd say the majority is still VMware, even in the Citrix space particularly. So if you're doing VDI or ZenApp, the majority of it is still on VMware vSphere. In 2013, 14, any one of those years, if I looked at the projects that we did and the percentage of them that were Hyper-V, SCVMM, mostly to support a Citrix infrastructure, but other server virtualization as well. 2013 was really the year of Hyper-V for our organization. We did more projects on Hyper-V and System Center in that year than we did in probably the combined 3 to 5 years prior. So a good amount of business going the Microsoft route, and a large part of that has to do with the fact that we're operating in a lot of state local education, or SLED as the industry calls it, where they get their Microsoft licensing virtually for free. I mean, it's so deeply discounted, it's not even funny.
Do you see Zen Server at all?
We do. 2014, I would say, if 2013 was the year of Hyper-V, 2014 was the year of Zen Server, and probably the biggest component of that was vGPU. So lots of NVIDIA projects, lots of customers wanting to do graphics virtualization, like my session was about at Brightform London. So yeah, lots of GPU and lots of customers that are trying to get more out of their desktop virtualization investment. And a big part of that has to do with the apps that they're running not being conducive for a non-GPU type of VDI experience.
Yeah, so let me ask you about that. So you know, I talked about, I think last year, maybe or 2 years ago, I think maybe it was last year, about the same kind of thing. Like, you know, GPU and vGPU is now a thing, especially when we look at VDI environments where people are trying to remote the entire desktop and we sort of need to all work. And for me, I was most interested in vGPU, not so much for the hard applications, but just for the run-of-the-mill, you know, IE and browsing the web and Office and just doing your regular dumb, boring apps on your desktop. You know, GPU is helpful. And I sort of looked at it like, you know, if you're building out a VDI environment, you're building out the hardware, you know, the cost, people are like, oh, these NVIDIA, you know, K-whatevers are so expensive. But it's like, yeah, but, you know, everything is expensive. And when you look at it, you're talking like 10% of the bill of materials, right? Like, why wouldn't you add 10% to the cost of all the super expensive stuff you're doing and give all your used GPUs? And I've been saying that a lot. I'm curious, does that, like...
You have, and I don't remember when you refreshed your VDI Delusions book, but I think that message resonated really well with the industry. People started to recognize that the two biggest pitfalls for graphics for desktop virtualization were graphics and storage, and I think that really helped kind of open people's mind in the industry that there's a better way to do this. The challenge even today, you know, years after you wrote that update, is that people still see it as an optional. And if they're going to cut costs, that's one of the ways that they cut is cutting out the optional. Where I think it's really going to impact the industry the most is when it stops being an optional. Either that's because, you know, the hyperconverged players of the space aren't giving any more options without graphics, or it's built into the E3 and E5 Intel processors, or whatever that may be. When we stop making it an optional, I think that's really when things are really going to accelerate from a graphics perspective.
That's a really good point, because how many desktop and laptop vendors, you know, how many Dell Optiplexes do they sell without a GPU?
Exactly. Or, my point, right? And tablets even, right? You can buy a $100 tablet and it's got, you know, well, maybe not an NVIDIA chip in it, but it's got an Atom chip that's got some graphics capability. The NVIDIA tablets are freaking expensive. Excuse my language, but they're expensive. Wait, and I know because I have a couple of them. What's that?
There's no FCC here. You can drop F-bombs. It's all right.
All right, cool.
but you know, this is a good point, because, you know, if you're going to be saving money on your Optiplex, you're getting, like, a smaller SSD or less memory or slower processor. Like, at no point... is cut the GPU. That's never an option. So why in the world? That's my article for tomorrow. I think I want to write that. Unless you've written that already, and then I'll link to it. But
I haven't written that one. But yeah, be my guest. I think the more that we talk about GPUs, the broader the understanding is going to be that it really shouldn't be something that is the first to get cut.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, people put it in the same category as, you know, the monitoring solutions. Oh, well, you know, we can run VDI without having a proper monitoring solution. Yeah, really? At scale? Probably not. Because being able to diagnose and understand where your bottlenecks are and where your pain points are, that's critical to running these types of environments at scale. And yet a lot of companies are like, well, if the vendor doesn't supply it, you know, VMware, Citrix, whoever, then I don't need a monitoring solution. And it's crazy to me, because it's like, you know, you wouldn't buy 5,000 desktops today without an image management strategy. Mm-hmm. You wouldn't roll out enterprise-wide XP to Windows 7 migration without some type of strategy for how you're going to get over that hump.
It's funny, because this is kind of a tangent, but like, people buy mobile devices that way, which is...
they're told the mobile devices are easier to manage than Windows. Like, hey, you know, they just install. There's no registry and there's no DLL hell. And so, like, what's there to do?
Yeah, especially in education. You know, I have a couple of friends that are teachers, and you know, getting into that, like, yeah, we have all these tablets, but you know, the ways that they hack around to you know, to manage them all on their own using consumer tools is actually pretty interesting.
It is, yeah.
So I was in Atlanta this past weekend, and while I was there, I saw Kevin. I actually stayed with Kevin Goodman. And he and I had this conversation about monitoring, where he was saying that, you know, it's interesting. It's, first of all, no one uses monitoring if everything is working, because what you're saying, like, they're not, you know, they're not, it's just not baked into the concept. So when people start, you know, if people start popping up and saying, I'm looking for monitoring solutions like 5,000 users, you know, they've got some troubles.
Yeah, exactly.
But you were saying but
the monitoring vendors can smell blood in the water then.
Well, you know, there are some companies who only make monitoring solutions for VDI and for Citrix, right?
Yep, absolutely.
Go to those vendors' websites and look at their customer list. Look at their references. And you know those are Citrix customers now. but it's funny because we were talking about this, what the problem is, and it's like we were almost wondering if monitoring is admission that your crazy, you know, kind of claptrap VDI solution you throw together is not going to work. And so if you go to your boss and like, oh yeah, we need VDI, it's a future, it's, you know, going to be all this wonderful, all the, you know, stuff, and they prove you a few million bucks, and you go out and build it, and you're like, okay, now we need something to monitor in case it breaks. And the boss is like, what do you mean in case it breaks? I thought you just told me this on the fact that it's way better.
And we need the rust proofing and
yeah. Monitoring is not rust proofing. That's next week's article.
Yeah, and I think it also relates to server virtualization as well. I remember a number of years back before server virtualization, the concept of having a monitoring solution for your physical servers was like, yeah, okay, maybe the big boys have that, but most everybody else, you use Task Manager and you use Perfmon, and if you've got an issue, you dive directly into the server, the physical server itself. But, you know, the second that we started putting all of this stuff onto the same shared stuff is the second that it became evident that we need a proper monitoring solution to figure out, you know, when is my file server completely overrunning my Exchange server and users' mailboxes aren't searchable anymore because there's no more I/O on the back end. So I think part of it also has to do with just, you know, convergence and putting everything in the same basket. Not everything plays well with everything else, so you have to figure out, you know, where are your bottlenecks and where are some applications being more problematic than others and causing all the resources to be consumed for those pigs of applications, whether it's file services or whatever it may be. So I think VDI is to a large extent the same thing. It's like, you know, most nobody, unless they're a very mature organization, has endpoint monitoring solutions where they're constantly evaluating the user experience on their laptops, desktops, or what have you. But the second that you move it into the data center and everything is converged on the same stuff, it becomes a lot more apparent that you need to be able to have a high-level view, a 30,000-foot view into what everything is doing so that you can identify when you're going to have bottlenecks or problem points or when you're just scaling beyond your capacity. I think that's probably the biggest thing that I've seen is people don't know when they're going to fall off the cliff. And a big part of desktop virtualization is anticipating that and not getting to that point where your organization comes to you and says, hey, can we support another 500 users on, you know, X, whatever we have today? And the IT guy with his hands cuffed behind his back says, yes, of course we can, because we don't have any budget to do anything else. And then next thing you know, it's, you know, the organization's pushed the environment off the cliff.
Well, it's interesting because we, you know, that's always been a problem in traditional desktops. It's just easier to ignore when it's only one person. And my girlfriend is a perfect example. So she has asked me, like, in her laptop, it's like Windows and Outlook and all this kind of stuff. And she, I don't remember what this was. This was a month or two ago. Something with Outlook. It wasn't that it wasn't. It was just doing something that was. I don't remember what it was. Like 20 minutes to open or 20, like something like that, right? And like, and the help desk just nothing. Like, yeah, that's weird. And like that's it. Just not, like it's just. So now it has to be like, okay, if I need to send emails, I need to, you know, like open up. I mean, it's, I don't remember what it was. It was something that's just a complete and wholly. You know, like dereliction of duty and no point, like it's just unusable, you know? And they're just like, yeah, that's as weird as doing that. And
sucks to be you.
Yeah. I mean, that was it. And if it's a VDI, and I guess maybe it's because, you know, in the traditional world, we only sort of screw one user at a time. And so VDI gives us the capabilities to screw everyone very quickly. And so maybe that's like we never really cared about end users to begin with. It's just that now if a bunch of them are yelling, that'll be loud enough that we actually have to respond to it.
Yeah. And I think, you know, every IT professional is created differently. But I think you're generalizing things a lot. And I would say that the large majority of people that have been working in IT for a period of time, they just, you know, they eventually tune out to the end user complaints.
Yeah, and I can see, so there is your MIS degree shining through, because, you know, my characterization is IT, my characterization is essentially IT people just want to screw their users. And you're like, well, I mean, okay, everyone's created differently, you know, it's, maybe they're tuning people out. Fair enough. Let me ask you about, let's shift gears here. So Workspace Cloud. I wrote a year ago, you know, 13 months ago when Citrix announced this at Synergy last year, that I believe this is the future of ZenApp and Zen Desktop. You are witnessing the future right here. At Synergy this past year, five, 6 weeks ago, Citrix showed sort of an update to Workspace Cloud, but they didn't announce anything concrete. They didn't announce timing, pricing. They showed a demo that a lot of people said, "Oh, that was like kind of like fake demo," and it was just really. And I and you know, and people asked me about what I was thinking with Workspace Cloud, and I was like, "Yeah, it seems awesome. I don't know if Citrix can like get it done fast enough, and who knows if they're way behind and all this kind of stuff." So that's a Synergy, like say 6 weeks ago, 5 weeks ago, you give a session at Bri Forum about Workspace Cloud. And people who attended that session were like, "Oh my God, this session was so great. Why did like these guys show this at Bri Forum? Why didn't Citrix show this at Synergy?" And since then, I've been talking to more people who are on the sort of the trials of Workspace Cloud and customers, and they love it. They love what Workspace Cloud is doing. They love. They're very excited about it. And they're certain Citrix is doing everything right. So I'm curious to hear like A, your thoughts about Workspace Cloud and what your experience is, and then B, what did you show at Bri Forum that Citrix didn't show at Synergy, and like, you know, what the hell?
So Synergy actually this year was full of demo hell. Somebody wasn't praying to the demo gods or something. I'm not sure exactly what went on, but I guess what I showed at Bri Forum was a functioning demo, which I guess is mind blowing. Go figure. So yeah, I did a session with Jarian Gibson, and we're going to do a repeat of it at Bri Forum Denver. So anybody that's U.S. based, if you haven't already registered, go do it now, and come out to Bri Forum Denver and particularly catch my session with Jarian on CWC. The main premise behind CWC and the part that I really grip onto is, in spite of the fact that, you know, I work at an integrator and the majority of our projects are time and materials based, and you would expect that we would want projects to go longer so that we have more billable income, that's not really, completely accurate. And CWC changes a lot of those dynamics from ultimately customers getting value out of, you know, whatever it is that they invested in, whether that's app and desktop virtualization or more of the life cycle side of operational management. And I think, you know, for me, having seen Citrix for as long as I have and the value that it can bring to organizations when integrated and implemented properly, I'm just really excited about the promise that is CWC and Citrix Lifecycle Management, which is a piece that is a component of that, bringing that value to customers' investments to shorten their time to get up and running. And, you know, the term in the industry is time to value.
Everything you're saying sounds very like businessy, and like I'm just like, what?
I'm sorry. So,
like,
it's
okay. I'm a ZenApp 6.5 customer. I'm a ZenApp 7 customer. I got ZenApp on vSphere. I got ZenApp on whatever. Workspace Cloud is coming out. Why do I care?
How many different data centers do you have? Because that historically has been a significant pain point to mid-market and larger customers. If you have any presence outside of the U.S., or let's just say you have regionalized data centers within the U.S., today it's a royal PITA to manage environments that are physically disparate. And a big part of that has to do with the fact that Citrix as a technology is really it's intended to be implemented within a single centralized data center, and then all of your users are outside of that. Well, when you have more than one data center, managing that can be a bit of a mess, especially because when you go from IMA to FMA, the concept of multi-zones within a farm, that concept's completely out the window. So there has to be some solution to a mid-market or larger customer that's managing multiple data centers. And the solution, which we heard about years and years ago with what they were calling Project Avalon at the time, is this concept of multi-site management. And the way that Citrix went about that, more or less, is through a cloud-managed control plane, very similar to the way that like ShareFile or Office 365 is managed. So from a certain degree, you minimize the amount of investment that's required for managing and operating the Citrix stuff while still gaining the flexibility to put your workloads wherever it makes sense to you. If they're in your four data centers that are globally dispersed, that's great. If you want to have some in Amazon or Azure, that's great. Wherever it makes sense for you to put your workloads, you have that flexibility to do that, but it still is managed from a central cloud-hosted control plane. Again, much like ShareFile, Office 365, a lot of the other players out there.
So we talk about like virtualization is about separating, you know, like the logical from the physical or whatever.
Right.
CWC, it's about separating sort of the management of your, we'll call it resources, Zen App servers, Zen desktops, whatever. It's about the separation of the management of those from the physical location of those.
Exactly.
So there's nothing fundamentally, you know, like quote-unquote cloud about CWC, except that it's if you separate the management from the location, then that therefore allows you to, you know, have some of them on your location, some in a remote office location, some in a cloud hosting provider location, and the physical locations of all your resources can be in all these different places, and you can still manage them as sort of one nice, you know, unified environment.
Exactly. And then the piece that kind of is the bow that holds everything together is the lifecycle management piece. And that's what's going to give a lot of customers that are sick and tired of the pain of administering different environments and having different configurations, either knowingly or unknowingly, their different environments look different. And that's just, you know, one of the nature of the way that this stuff works. So Citrix Lifecycle Management is a piece that kind of is that bow that wraps everything together to say, instead of configuring and building everything manually, you configure a blueprint. And then you take that blueprint and you say, okay, I want this blueprint here, here, and here. And it goes out and it deploys those infrastructure pieces identically in those different locations. So that's kind of the other value add of CWC.
So if you had this, you showed like a demo working in your session, and at Synergy they said they would, I don't remember what the exact wording was, like, we'll announce pricing availability later this summer, or like I'm wondering what the next steps are and how long it is until this is just like the way that you do things.
Yeah. So the immediate takeaway from Synergy was, if customers are interested, they should reach out to their Citrix support rep or their trusted partner and get on the early access, you know, basically tech preview, if you will. So that option is available. We have a couple customers that have already expressed interest and are jumping on board there. But ultimately, customers aren't going to make decisions, this is the direction we're going or not, until they see what the bottom line dollar amount is going to be.
Because that could be the make or break it for this, right? Because, I mean, ZenApp Zen Desktop, you know, suite or whatever is already like $700 a user by the time you're all in. And, you know, in my mind, this should just be not an additional cost. It should just be like the way it works now, like your $700 per user, which already allows you to deploy as many servers and backend instances and all that as you need to make it work. Why isn't this just, you know, Zen App 8? Like, why is this a separate thing?
Well, I think the short story of that is that Citrix, much like Office 365, isn't giving customers the choice of where they want their control plane to sit. So the traditional stuff is still going to be needed for those customers that refuse to have anything touching, you know, private, externally managed control plane type of stuff, mm-hmm. right? So, you know, some customers are going to stay traditional Citrix customers, and the piece about CWC that is the value is the fact that they implement, you know, what the industry in agile development has called evergreen, where things are constantly patching, things are constantly getting updated, and the customer is responsible for a piece of that, kind of like me going to the app store and saying, yeah, download this update, but they're not responsible for all the other stuff that's involved in getting those features and those new releases pushed out. They're just responsible for their client side. Okay, go ahead and I'll take that update now. So the way that I see this long-term playing out, which is going to be pretty awesome if they can pull it off, is CWC is where all the new features, all the new hotness goes first. And as those products, features, new capabilities get more mature, eventually they'll come to the on-prem version that the through feature packs, service packs, and everything else. But the customers that refuse to use the cloud, they're going to have a bit of a lag between new features developed and released and when they're available on the on-premises version. So if you want to be a bleeding edge, you know, technology hardcore customer, you go to CWC, you get all the features the day that they come out, which is the way that consumerization is moving things. And if you can't tolerate that, then you still have an on-premises managed option available. And to a large extent, it's identical to the way Microsoft has run Office 365. I couldn't tell you.
You can still buy Office, or pardon me, you still buy Exchange and Office and SharePoint.
Precisely. Yeah. Precisely. So if you want to manage it yourself and you've got the IT support staff to do that, you still have the option. But I couldn't tell you what version of Exchange Office 365 is running because I'm not responsible for it.
Right. It probably is not even the same, like it's probably not Exchange. It's like, you know, Microsoft custom special and it's updated.
Yeah. And Microsoft likes to do that too. Like, oh yeah, Azure, it's running on Hyper-V. Really? You don't say. The same commercially available Hyper-V that I can download on a Windows Server ISO, really? That may be the case, but I guarantee you, you're not managing it with System Center Virtual Machine Manager because that's a pile.
Well, it's so, like when Microsoft ran, Hotmail ran on Linux forever. it was like Solaris or something like that.
Yeah.
So, okay. So shifting gears again.
Shifting gears.
Moonshot. I don't like it.
Cool. And sounds good.
And go.
I just want to be clear on this. I don't like the idea of like a blade PC or a cartridge per user. I like, of course, it guarantees you the resources. It's more, you know, it's more predictable. It's very linear scalability, and all the users are a little isolated and that kind of stuff. But the Moonshot cartridge itself is so expensive and so underpowered. I just can't possibly see a scenario where that is better than just buying like a 2U like regular server. Like, yeah. And the problem I have is the Moonshot cartridge, it's pure math. Each Moonshot cartridge is 45 watts, but you're putting four users on that 45 watts. That's 11 watts a user. Mm-hmm. Like, there's not enough that can be done in 11 watts per user to give anyone anywhere close to like a normal human style, you know, Windows desktop computing experience. And then on top of that, they're like, oh, look at the density. But, you know, it only takes three Moonshot chassis to max out the power consumption of an entire rack, the power rating. So you can't just fill your regular rack with Moonshots. Like, you put three of them in there and fill those up, and then you've got, you know, another like 30 U's of blank space because you've maxed out the wattage of your rack. So I don't get, like, so they're, okay, yeah, so it's like physically, you know, they're very, very dense, but I don't know, but they're so expensive. They're too dense for the power your rack can handle. They're so underpowered. I don't understand why you wouldn't just, you know, buy a bunch of like regular, like R720s, whatever, rack them, stack them, and then just, you know, give users like one-to-one VDI that way, which I believe will be way better performance and way cheaper. So that's, I'm telling you that this is my bias going into it. And I recognize, by the way, that you do not work for, HP or Moonshot or whatever. You're giving presentation about Moonshot and Citrix and that kind of stuff. I'm saying, right, like, here's why I don't like Moonshot. I'm curious, does that make sense what I'm saying, or am I like misinformed, or, are there use cases I'm not thinking about? Or is that, maybe that's all true and you just get a good deal on it, so you do it anyway. You know, I'm not really sure.
Let me just start by saying that all of your objections are objections that I've heard before. Yeah. And yet, for some reason, customers continue to buy it. So go figure. My first exposure to Moonshot is probably, you know, the furthest back of anybody outside of HP. We had early access because they saw that we were their go-to partner for virtualization in the West, and they said, hey, we want to get you guys one of these chassis and you guys can hammer away at it and play with it. And that's going on 21 months ago or so now. So the kind of the history of Moonshot is a single chassis currently. They haven't developed a second chassis form factor yet, but single chassis that can fit multiple cartridge types, and there's networking options available for whatever cartridge type you need. So the first cartridge that came out was an Atom-based cartridge. It was intended for web workloads. Not terribly successful, and, you know, if it was successful, it wasn't really in the customers that we're talking to, because that's more of the, you know, the dot-com hosters and things like that, that, you know, it's not typically the customer space that we're working in. Yeah. So there's the first cartridge, which more or less was a proof of concept. Does this idea work? Is it better to have workloads directly on hardware again instead of on a hypervisor with scheduling and everything else that goes along with that? The first cartridge for end-user computing, I would say, is a very similar type of answer. It was the proof of concept for the industry. Is this way of doing things a way that is viable, is economical, is something that customers will latch onto? That was a cartridge that was called the M700, so ProLiant M700 cartridge. It was an AMD-based cartridge. That's the one that you're mostly referring to when you're talking about single node per user, and the users connect in and they have dedicated discrete hardware. I would say that fits just fine if a customer is typically deploying 2 CPU, 4 gigs of memory, 60 gig hard drives per VDI desktop, and they want to have a more consistent user experience that's not impaired by, again, that problem where you're putting everything in the same spot. There's going to be convergence problems that happen with system resources, so you want to more or less guarantee the user experience, all factors except for network, which is the variable that's left.
Like, haven't, and, you know, I'm not the VDI expert here, but, like, hasn't that been figured out by now?
You'd be surprised. You would be surprised. The number of customers that have gotten over the hump of using traditional storage for VDI, it continues to astound me. That, you know, there are still deployments that we run into, or that customers insist on, where they're not even using flash storage or some type of accelerated storage, and they're trying to run VDI at scale using traditional storage architectures. There's scenarios where the CFO is breathing down the CIO or the director of IT's throat and saying, I don't care what it's going to cost. Tell me I can get another 500 users on XYZ block of compute. And the IT department is got their hands strapped and has to put that many more users on it. So you'd be surprised how much resource contention still comes up, which, you know, going back to the monitoring companies, that's why they exist, because everybody's got a black eye from running their environments too hot. Now, if everybody uniformly decided, we're going to size this for 1,000 users per building block, but we're only ever going to run 500 on them so that there's always 50% overhead available for either compute or memory or storage, whatever it may be. You'd probably be right. That problem would be figured out. But most organizations, especially in desktop virtualization, because you're competing with the physical PC, which has become commoditized to the point where it's virtually nothing to buy, that's the challenge with VDI, is like everybody's trying to run to zero, and that's not going to be the best for user experience.
So if this is what it takes to like force discipline, good for HP?
I guess.
I don't want to get too off track, because you were talking about, you know, that's the M700 cartridge, which is like four users to one.
Exactly.
But I'm guessing you were going to talk about, you know, more a little higher end users where it's more dedicated to cartridges.
Yeah, and the next cartridge that they're released for end user computing is what they call the M710 cartridge. And the M710 is more of a, not a modern PC, because most, or not a modern server, because most modern servers are dual Xeons with 256 gigs of memory, but more or less the servers that you would have bought 5 years ago to run your Citrix environment. Each cartridge has about that processing capability. So it's got lots of CPU resources, 32 gigs of memory, lots of SSD options that are available. And if you're going to run a single user on that cartridge, it's going to be expensive, but the user is going to get an optimal experience that has graphics, that has lots of CPU resources, memory, and disk. And the other important part is it's certified for Windows Server, so you can run it as XenApp, which is going back a couple years in time to the way that, you know, Intesis and other partners were designing Citrix environments 5 to 7 years ago. Don't use a hypervisor. Don't use shared storage. Use physical, you know, 1U pizza box servers. Stream your operating system using provisioning services and run your workloads bare metal to get all of the horsepower out of that server. So Moonshot is kind of going back to that way of doing things, where you're streaming the XenApp operating system into an M710 cartridge. And then depending on your workload, you're getting 15 to 50 users per cartridge. So that's where the math works out in your favor, to getting more users per density than you would with a rack-based server or blade server type of approach.
But you don't have GPUs in there.
You do. You have Iris Pro graphics.
Okay, so that's...
Yeah, so that's kind of going back to the point that I made about graphics very early on.
Yeah.
When, as an industry, we make it to the point where customers can't say, can you remove that GPU from that Moonshot cartridge? No, because it's soldered onto the processor. Shut up. Like, you're not going to remove GPU from this cartridge. It's there whether you like it or don't like it, or need it or don't need it. Every user that jumps into a XenApp session is going to have hard GPU resources available for their workload. It's not the same as, you know, an NVIDIA K1 or K2 dedicated to a user, but, you know, not every workload's created equal. It'd be just fine for, you know, Microsoft Office and Lite applications that need some GPU acceleration, internet browsers, things like that. So that's kind of going back to that point about when GPUs are everywhere and customers don't have an option of saying, hey, I need to cut the budget by 10%. I'm going to rip the GPU out of there. That's when we're going to see the industry take off in terms of adoption. And if I were a predicting man, I would say that the same type of thing we're going to see in server processors in the Intel E5 series is processors in, you know, 3 to 5 years, where it's going to be piped through the hypervisor. GPU is just going to be there. It's going to come standard with your CPU resources on the same processor, just like they're doing with the E3 in Moonshot.
You see people using the 710s in a one-to-one way, like for VDI?
You would be surprised. Yeah, I got some heavy-hitting customers that actually said 32 gigs that each cartridge has is not enough. I need to dedicate a cartridge for a user, but when's the 64-gig option coming out?
And there your 45 watts is okay, because, I mean, you know, like 45 watts is a laptop. So, like, you know, now I feel like we're more within the range of being able to deliver an experience that's okay to users.
Exactly. Yep. And it's putting it in the data center, which ultimately, you know, the reason why a lot of us have been doing Citrix is you get LAN speed access to your data and your applications. The user experience is going to be better. You just have the network to deal with.
Yeah, I mean, that's the, yeah, that's the same. We've been talking about for 20 years.
Yep.
I mean, and I.
Well, you've been talking about it for 20 years. I haven't been talking.
Okay, cool. So that's good. So I feel good about that. So thank you for letting me like.
You're still not going to buy it, but you do feel better about the fact that other people are buying it.
Yeah, I'm not buying any of the stuff. Like, yeah. I use laptops. I mean, you know,
I've got my MacBook Pro. I'm happy.
I don't even care. You know what? It doesn't. So I talked to Jeff McNaught at, you know, he's the guy from Wyze who now is at Dell. You know, kind of heading up there, like end user computing, you know, program or whatever.
Okay.
And I saw him at Synergy, and even he was talking about like, oh yeah, we got this new Dell XPS 13 or whatever. It's got like whatever they are now, 3,000 pixels by 4,000 pixels, and like edge to edge screen and all this stuff. And yeah. He's asking if I wanted to try it. And I'm like, yeah, that's fine because I don't even care. Like yeah, I've been a Mac user for the past I don't know, say 10 years or so.
Yep.
But frankly, I don't even care about Mac. Like it doesn't even matter. Like really, whether I use Windows or Mac. Plays no bearing. I mean, mm-hmm. I have a browser. I mean, that's my. And frankly, yeah. I used to say my platform is Chrome, but even that's not true because I recently got off of Chrome and now I'm playing with Safari and Firefox. Like, I don't even think I can. Yeah. Like, I really, my platform is Dropbox and like some browser, and it just doesn't matter beyond that.
You need a Mozilla book.
Is the Mozilla book a thing?
Well, the phone is.
Hey, Dennis. Our other brother Dennis is here. You got your buddy Mike. He works at Mozilla, right? What is he doing? The phone or the laptops? Phone. They have a phone OS, yeah. Yeah. Huh.
There you go.
Yeah. They like. Yeah. Our other brother's friend who's here works for them, and they apparently have a phone. And so, yeah. Maybe there is a Mozilla. Like Jack, you said. I know it's a joke, but there might be a Mozilla book. So, okay, cool. Well, thank you for letting me take, you know, like 53 minutes to grill you on your Brightform sessions, you know, past and upcoming. So now I've got 7 minutes to discuss current events.
Okay.
Like Windows 10 and the world of the future?
Yeah. So
Windows 10. Yes.
Okay. So here's my question on Windows 10. Like, first of all, I mean, I love Windows 10 as a concept. I think everyone's going to be skipping, you know, Windows 8, obviously, and going to Windows 10. It's going to be really big and all that kind of stuff. There's a story.
History will repeat itself yet again.
Yeah, exactly. for every other operating system. Did you guys see the story this week of how – so Microsoft has a goal to get Windows 10 on 1 billion devices. And they also have, like, you know – which is easier when you basically make everything you do called Windows 10. So they have, you know – Windows Phone is now Windows 10.
Xbox
and,
Windows 10 Edition.
Dude, you're laughing like you're joking.
I am joking. I'm not joking.
You are not joking. they're internet. So there's Windows 10, like Internet of Things edition.
Yeah, which is basically embedded.
Well, no. So they have embedded, right? So they have Windows embedded. But they also have, like, you can put this on, like, Raspberry Pi and, like, BeagleBone and even, like, Arduino. But here's the thing. Arduino is a microcontroller. It doesn't have, like, Arduino is very, very basic. Like, you're not running, like, Linux on an Arduino, you know? But it's that they wrote this, like, sort of interface kit so you can use APIs to take the Arduino and Raspberry Pi and these other, like, you know, propeller boards and these kinds of things and interface them to Windows. But they're calling, like, the API, essentially, that talks to an Arduino, like, Windows 10, like, IoT edition, or it's not called IoT edition, but something like that. So, like, all those are going to count. But here's the crazy thing. They're giving away Windows 10 for free.
Yep.
And those are the articles, like, that came out in the past week where basically this is not for businesses, but anyone who signed up for the Windows Insider program, which you can go to like insider.microsoft.com, and that's like getting access to the early Windows preview, you know, this kind of stuff. You can download right now the Windows, like, you know, trial versions. You can do fresh installs. You don't need to do an upgrade of an existing license thing. It's what all my Windows 10 is running that's on Fusion, where I'm just doing a brand new install from the ISOs I downloaded. Mm-hmm. And they say in this program that you will get a... once this you know, Insider program is done and Windows is available, you will be able to, you know, download a the update that is fully activatable, you know, reinstallable, all this kind of stuff. So basically, anyone who's in this Windows Insider program has, like, for free, you know, full Windows 10, home or professional, which to me seems like
pretty crazy. Yeah. And I think that's a rinse and repeat of the past as well, but a different spin on it. I mean, I think it's great that they're giving away for free, but if you look at what Microsoft did in education, where Apple significantly failed, they missed their opportunity. I don't know if you remember, but used to be Macs were huge in schools, but
yeah.
You know, then they transition, and then all the schools were running PCs because Microsoft licensing was basically for free. And it's the same type of concept. You put it everywhere, everybody's going to want to learn that platform, and then you charge the businesses because the businesses are the ones with the deep pockets to pay the licensing. So it's a similar type of approach. You indoctrinate people when they're young, and when they exit college, they're going to be working in a Windows world. So I think that's kind of their strategy with the billion devices thing, and the fact that they're giving it away for, you know, basically consumers is actually pretty cool. I think that's great.
Yeah, and I mean, it seems that, and obviously Microsoft is a big, massive, complex beast doing, you know, going a whole bunch of different directions, but I kind of feel, I don't know, man, those Surface tablets, I'm seeing those more and more. And like what they're doing around Windows and Windows 10, and I don't know. I almost wonder if like it might actually catch on this time.
And like laptops maybe. That are the price of a Chromebook, but you know,
fully featured Windows 8. Yeah.
Yeah.
And even if it means they have to give away it for free, so what? I mean, they got money.
Yeah, so. And they did that thing with the smaller screen sizes a while ago as well, where they had either free edition or different device edition for whatever it was, less than 7 inches or something, less than 10 inches, something like that.
And people criticize Microsoft because, oh my gosh, they have to stoop to giving it away for free to get people to use it. I'm like, sorry, didn't you just describe every single internet startup? Like, literally, that is what Gmail and Facebook and every single other startup, that is exactly what they do.
Yep.
It'll be free. We'll get lots of users. Then we'll figure out how to make money.
Yep, exactly.
And don't worry,
they're mining your data and they're selling that for profit.
Right, which is probably so much more valuable than the actual amount that you would pay. Like, it's, I'm going to pay for, you know, like, you know, if people are like, oh, I wish there was a pay for version of Facebook that was like $20 a year.
Yeah. So I didn't have to deal with the ads.
Dude, you would have to pay $1,000 a year to use Facebook with no ads. Then to break even.
But is one person to market to that valuable?
I mean, we're
getting into different territory here, but
I mean, you know, you can count up Facebook, figure out like active Facebook users, you know. And then look at Facebook revenue, and you can like work out what the exact value is.
Yep.
But anyway, all right, we have like just another minute or two. But Jack, what have you been doing in the past? Like, what's happening? Did we talk about Worldwide Developer Conference last week? Is that a few weeks ago? I don't remember now.
That was a few weeks ago. I'll sum it up. Because I wrote an article yesterday called something along the lines of like, even though enterprise mobility isn't very mature, enterprise mobility management is. And this is actually like one of the points that – or it's nearing maturity. And this is one of the points that I hit on in my – like whatever my 20-minute session at Synergy was. And this is the first time I included in a presentation that like if you look at it, you know, the like the Apple MDM updates every year, they're fairly small, and you know, like they're things that a fairly limited audience would be interested in. And so, like in when it comes to managing iPhones, you know, that's pretty mature. And of course, Android for work is just rolling out. So in like you know 2 years, that'll be. After it drifts into the ecosystem, that will be ready and there to go. So that's if I can say that like that's a theme for now. Like a lot of the many EMM questions are answered. And the question now is more like, so this enterprise mobility thing in general, how are we going to get started?
Right. Yeah, right.
Exactly.
Dane, do you see in your business, like when you're consulting and stuff, are your sort of, you know, like traditional Citrix, like Zenapp, Zendesktop customers, are they the same people who are doing mobility, and are they thinking about Zen Mobile and tying that into Zenapp, Zendesktop? Or for most customers, is this like a different department and it doesn't really cross over?
I think it's a mixed bag. Some organizations, it's managed by the people that manage Exchange, or even sometimes the people that are dealing with the AT&T or Verizon contracts. You know, they're the people that get stuck with the mobility because they're the ones doing asset management, things like that. The biggest challenge with, you know, being in Sacramento Bay Area is the fact that a lot of our customers that we're working with actually want to see value out of a mobility solution before they'll enable or before their users will accept having their device managed. So a lot of it has to do with more, you know, what's the value to the customer? What's the value to the user of having this solution? And right now, with, you know, state of the industry, you guys know it better than anyone, with the whole app wrapping and all of the dynamics there, it's really, you know, it's challenging to create a value proposition for why users would want to have their devices managed in order to get XYZ features. But I think that's going to change. I don't know, Jack, if you've been covering any of the potential for dynamic app wrapping, but I think that's going to change the space quite a bit, especially in Citrix context.
Yeah, yeah. It's all that is, admittedly, it's a huge mess.
Exactly.
But bottom line is it all comes down to whether or not a company has apps that matter. And, you know, they'll it's got to be approached on an app by app basis. And mm-hmm. then if you have an app that matters, what you need to have in place, whether that's, you know, managing devices, because we figure like companies that aren't managing devices today, or doing anything to secure mobile email or anything, like obviously they're not just going to wake up tomorrow and be like, you know, we haven't been doing this for 5 years, but maybe now is the day. No, they'll be looking into EMM once they realize that they have some apps that matter other than, you know, like something beyond email and Box and Salesforce.
Right.
And then they'll realize like, oh, hey, we want some apps that really matter to us, and we need some way to coordinate that and make that work. And whether it comes to app wrapping, or we're developing them our own and using that as a place to inject our mobile app management, or, you know, using the device containerization, those are questions that you can answer on your, like on your path of figuring out how we're going to deal with this app that matters.
Yeah. So I think if I would just add and summarize what we see in the field are actually the stereotypical customers that would want devices managed and don't have, you know, BYO policies. Those are the ones that we have been doing implementations for EMM. A good chunk of that is Zen Mobile, but, you know, we're also partners with other players out in the space.
Do people use Zen Mobile like enterprise versus what's the one? Standard? What are the names? The cheap one versus the expensive one? Which one do they use?
Well, there's a MDM edition, there's an app edition, and then there's Enterprise, which is basically MDM plus app. So, interestingly, Citrix, like they do, you know, every year when they need to spur on more sales, they come up with very interesting sales campaigns, and one of the big ones has been around bundling the Zen App, Zen Desktop license with Zen Mobile, Citrix Workspace Suite. And instead of customers doing renewals to just keep on whatever they've got, you know, Zen App or Zen Desktop licensing, their sales rep will make them a killer deal to get the Zen Mobile licensing as well because of Citrix Workspace Suite. So I think that's probably the primary way that customers get into getting licenses is they already have, you know, existing Citrix license base, and then their sales rep makes them a killer deal to get that plus Zen Mobile.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Well, hey, I think we're over time, so I think we should wrap up. But Dane Young, thank you so much for joining us today. It was a pleasure to chat with you. You are out there in the world. You've got you're speaking at Bride Forum in Denver about a month from now. Yep. I know you you're blogging on itvce.com, correct?
Yep.
And you've got is it your podcast or there's a bunch of folks that do a podcast over there, I think, as well.
Yeah, we've got a couple co-hosts. We try to get together regularly, I'd say once a month or so, talking about end-user computing. So that one's EUCpodcast.com.
Sweet, EUC Podcast. And anything else you want to plug or other places we can go and look for you?
Just Twitter, at YoungTech. It's pretty easy. My last name and T-E-C-H.
All right, awesome. Well, Dane Young, thank you so much for the time.
Yeah, thanks, Brian. Thanks, Jack.
See you in I don't follow you on Twitter. Well, look at that. Well, I do now. There you go.
Oh, my goodness. I have a new Twitter follower.
Bam-o. Look for that email. yeah. So we'll see you in Denver in a month.
All right. Sounds great.
So, Jack, thanks for the time. Justin, our engineer. Mariah, who's our project manager. Just manager of in general. Thank you for your help, too. And Gabe, wherever you are, somewhere on an airplane, hello. And we'll see you here on the next podcast.
All right. Thanks, everyone.